Now, we are coming near to the end of a wee series on the parables, and the way that I structured these, knowing that I'm going to at some point soon be doing a series on Revelation, I've chosen parables that lead us toward more apocalyptic type of parables. So we're in Matthew 24, and the disciples are asking Jesus, when is the end? When is it all going to wrap up? And Jesus gives a series of talks related to that. And we're going to look at from verse 37. But before we do that, I have a question for you, or an imaginary scenario. Let's imagine that Jesus comes to you in a dream. Apparently, he's doing this in the Muslim world all over the place, showing up and saying, hey, follow me. Imagine he comes to one of his believers, and you're one of those believers, and he says to you, right, as it says in my word, I told James to say this, faith without works is dead. So, before I return, I'm going to give you an option to show that your faith is real. What kinds of works are you going to do? So here's your options. You can either do one great thing, a sort of a Nobel Prize winning thing, or New Zealander of the Year type of thing, or Australian of the Year, Indian of the Year, whatever it is, a major thing. And the rest of your life, I'm not going to look at that, but it has to be good. One great thing. Or you can just live a life of doing lots of little things, but it has to be the rest of your life. You can't falter. I don't know what it was like for you when you were in high school or college, whether you had to sit exams, spend a whole year pouring knowledge into your brain for a three-hour test to prove that whole year hadn't been a complete waste. Imagine God said, that one test, you've got to get 100%, or it's a fail. And what they do now a lot more is internal assessment. Everything you do has been assessed. You can't let up. But there's no one moment in your entire year where you're going to succeed or fail. It's a series of little moments all along the way that will give you that end grade. Which would you choose? Which would you prefer? One big failing test. That's what happened. Neither of the above. The last one. You'd rather just be lots of little things along the way. Say again. Yes, if you'd had done a lot of things along the way, you would have been better. That's right. It's a false test. Because to become a Nobel Prize winner, you have had to have dedicated your life to that anyway. There is no one great thing that you'll do without having spent a life dedicated to achieving that, right? So any big thing that anyone does is always made up of lots of little things, a consistent effort. And Jesus is faced with these disciples who are asking, so when will it happen? Now, and he says a bunch of things and say, well, we know when there's wars and rumors of wars and famine and all sorts of bad things, they're just the signs, but it's not the end. The end hasn't come yet. Now, and I don't know whether what he says in these three little parables, whether he knows exactly what's in their heart. I suspect he does. But I get the feeling what he's trying to tell them is, you've got to stop wondering when I'm coming and just know that I am. Just know that I am. One of the guys who works on site here for Far East Broadcasting Company, Matt Perry, he has a saying. He kind of wanders through the hallways and goes, look busy everyone, Jesus is coming. This sort of sense of expectation that you don't want to be caught on the toilet. Ah! Don't snatch me up now, Lord. Give me a moment. For as were the days of Noah, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. For as in those days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage until the day when Noah entered the ark, and they were unaware until the flood came and swept them all away, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. As in the days of Noah, who's familiar with the Noah story? Yeah? The great flood? It's the only example we have in history and in scripture of a worldwide judgment, isn't it? So it makes sense that Jesus is comparing the next worldwide judgment to the original, if you like. They will not be the same, but there's going to be a lot of comparison. As in the days of Noah. Now, what were they doing in the days of Noah, can I just ask, from your knowledge? Depraved. That's a big word. What does it mean? Living in sin. That's a cliche. What does that mean? So they were doing what God says not to do. Right, okay. We'll go with that for now. Anyone else? Just getting on with their lives. Just living. That's certainly what Jesus says in the parable. That's how he describes it. If you were to read Genesis again, it would say that they were violent. They were violent. I mean, Jesus doesn't condemn, or God, I don't think, condemns people for just living a normal life. Eating, drinking. I mean, eating and drinking doesn't mean overeating and overdrinking, doesn't it? It just means that's what you do daily. Most of our days are caught up to some degree or another, eating and drinking. Not a bad thing. Marrying and giving in marriage. Isn't that a good thing? So in a sense, I think Jesus is saying, as you had just pointed out, they were just going about their lives, which is kind of different to what is said in Genesis when God judges them for being violent. I mean, they weren't just going about their lives according to Genesis, but when Jesus retells the story, that's exactly what they're doing. Just going about their daily business. And here's Noah. What's Noah doing? In the days of Noah, while everyone else is having just a nice life, Noah's busy building a boat. Now, if this was a small little cruise for his family, a little recreational craft, a little fishing boat maybe, just for him and his family, he could have probably done that as a hobby. You know, eat and drink, marry and give in marriage, and on the side, just build this little craft, this little vessel that he and his family could just launch on weekends for the fun of it. But unfortunately for Noah, when God gave him the schematics, his heart must have sank into his toes. I'm going to have no time for Noah. I've got a really big boat to build here, and I'm on a deadline. Literal deadline. I better get busy. In the days of Noah, while everyone else is just going about their lives, Noah's not. Noah's got no time for Noah. He's building a boat, which will save him and his family, but let's face it, it's probably oversized if it's just for them. This is enormous because it's going to have to carry to safety pairs of animals of every kind on earth to save them too. So Noah's having to give up and put aside Noah's life, the easy, just going about the good things of life, to build this jolly vessel. And can we imagine? Probably we can't, but let's just try. Imagine the sense of relief as he and his family put on the final lick of tar and coil the final ropes as those first drops begin to fall. And he gathers, and all the animals have gathered inside, and the Lord closes the door. Though the flood must have been absolutely terrifying, and the sense of grief and loss as everything is wiped out and everyone he knows is gone, there also must have been this enormous sense of it is done. I put my life into this. And because of that, I've saved many lives. It is finished. I have gathered all the provisions. I have built the boat. The animals are in. My family is safe. And we will ride this out. And I will go into my rest as a good and faithful servant. Fast forward a few weeks. And it's time to go back out of this boat. The flood is over. It's starting to dry out. And the doors come down. What does Noah see? Sorry? Death and desolation. He sees a rainbow. Eventually he gets there. Yeah. What a mess. Have you seen those the footage of floods in communities? Like, the water doesn't have to be very high for those houses to be completely ruined and needing to be torn down and rebuilt, right? It only needs to be even just up to your knees, and all the filth that is in that water soaking into the buildings, making them unrepairable. And we're talking about a worldwide devastating flood, which when Noah looks out on this earth, any comfort that they had built for themselves, any cities, any farms, any orchards, any vineyards, everything is gone in an absolute mess. Now let's just hope for their sake that the bodies have gone. That's the best case scenario. But the reality is, Noah, coming out of the boat, realizes he thought his work was done, but now he's got to do the rebuild on his own. Again. Ugh. I was last in Christchurch about this time last year. How long has it been since the earthquake? There are still gaping holes in the city, and they've got a whole city of people and resources to rebuild. And they've got hardly anywhere with it. He thought building the boat took all of his life and all of his energy and was a major task. And he thought he was done. And he comes out, and it's a major mess again. And it's all on him to rebuild. And so the scriptures say that he becomes a farmer, from boat builder to farmer. At least he's learning some skills. And he creates a vineyard. And what does he do? All right, Jesus assesses the situation and says they were caught unaware because they were just eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage. What does Noah start to do once he's got some things going? Starts to eat and drink. Drinks a little much. Ah, look, I'm not there to judge him. This guy's had a lot of work he's had to do in his life. He's had little pleasure for himself. He tips a little bit too much, and then he's drunk. And his youngest sees him. Happens to be naked as well. I don't know why that was necessary. And this youngest laughs at him. Gets the other two older brothers to come and have a look. But the two older brothers have a little more respect for their father, and they cover him up. And when Noah realizes what's happened, out of the four chapters, this big story, Noah has only 46 words. He says nothing up until this point. He's just been an action man, going and do stuff. And his only words are to curse his youngest son and then to bless his older two sons by doubling down on the curse. So the curse is this: you will serve your older brothers. This is Noah. Noah's saying to his son, you will serve your older brothers the rest of your life. Your life will be in service to everyone else. I curse you with that. Now, are we getting this? What was Noah's life like up to this point? A life of service to everything else. No time for Noah. And in his deepest despair, in his greatest frustration, we see how much that cost him, because he sees it as a curse, and he curses his youngest with the same life. Just one way to read the story. Which will be important, because as we go on to the next couple of little parables, imagine them a bit like a Russian doll, where each parable nests inside the other, carrying similar features, but it's held within this larger story of, remember Noah? And in the days of Noah, when there was only one person who willingly gave up their life of ease to serve God and save others, though it cost him. Then two men will be in the field. One will be taken and one left. Two women will be grinding at the mill. One will be taken and one left. Therefore, stay awake, for you do not know on what day your Lord is coming. I find this image kind of interesting, particularly in the context of the Left Behind series. Is anyone aware of the Left Behind series? The way the series goes, it imagines a particular scenario in which God will save his faithful by taking them away from the earth before the final judgment. And if you read Revelation, there's some fairly heavy things coming. So the idea is that the Lord is going to protect his faithful by taking them away from the earth before the bad things come. Now, connecting this to the story of Noah, because of course this does connect to the story of Noah, in the story of Noah, who is taken away? The sinners. Who is left behind? Noah and everyone else. So we've got a bit of a strange scenario, really, haven't we? Where those who are left behind, the faithful ones, are left behind to do the rebuild. Whereas yet we're trying to teach Christians that you're supposed to get out of the world and leave it to, I don't know what, leave it to wreck and ruin. It seems a little bit back to front, doesn't it? Particularly the way Jesus sees it. Those who are going to be left behind are those who are going to be left behind to do work, to rebuild, to our Father in heaven, hallowed be your name, your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Know this, that if the master of the house had known in what part of the night the thief was coming, he would have stayed awake and would not have let his house be broken into. Therefore, you also must be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour you do not expect. So we're told to stay awake. We're told to remain alert. And then Jesus says, but the thief is coming when you don't expect him. Stay awake, but the thief is coming when you won't expect him. Now, how long can you stay awake? I've done 48 hours. It's pretty tiring. I would be easy to sneak up on at the end of 48 hours. It would be a breeze to sneak up on me after 48 hours. How long can you stay alert for? Which is it, Lord? You're either going to come when we don't expect it, like a thief, or we can genuinely stay awake and be alert to your coming. Now, the thing about a thief is they have every advantage, don't they? Because they know, they alone know when they're going to strike. And I'm sure, like me, you've seen those heist movies when the robbers case the place. They scan the room or the buildings and they work out where all the closed circuit TV cameras are, and they work out what kind of burglar alarm systems are in place, and they work out where all the sentries and their Dobermans are going, and they work out the entire situation so that they can build a plan to penetrate. Now, I'm pretty sure that they didn't have closed circuit TV in Jesus' day, nor did they have mechanical alerts They relied on people to stay awake. The thief has the advantage because the thief alone knows when they're going to come. The thief will come when you're asleep. The thief will come when you're not ready. The thief will attack your weak spot. So how can you be ready? How can you be awake? How can you be alert when in the end the thief is going to get you anyway? All right, Jesus says that. If you had known when the thief was coming, you would have stopped the thief. And actually, that's all you need, isn't it? You don't need all these fancy systems. As long as you know when the thief is coming, you just wait at the front door. You don't need anything fancy. The fact is, and the point Jesus is making is, you cannot know. So what does he mean? He's putting us in a bind. You're telling me I'm supposed to stay awake. At the same time, you're telling me, the moment I fall asleep, that's when the thief will strike. Who then, and Jesus goes on to help us understand some of this, who then is the faithful and wise servant whom his master has set over his household to give them their food at the proper time? Blessed is that servant whom his master will find so doing when he comes. Truly I say to you, he will set him over all his possessions. But if that wicked servant says to himself, my master is delayed, and begins to beat his fellow servants and eats and drinks with drunkards, the master of that servant will come on a day when he does not expect him, and at an hour he does not know, and will cut him in pieces and put him with the hypocrites. In that place there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. How can you be ready for the coming of the Lord when his coming will be like a thief? Coming when you cannot expect him. Coming like those days of Noah, when you will be busy eating and drinking, marrying or giving in marriage, going about your daily life. How can you be ready when he will come when you're not ready? Well, Jesus has already taught this very stuff. We already know. It was in last week's sermon. Therefore, I tell you, says Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount, store for yourself treasures in heaven, where thieves can't take it. Anything you store on earth, moth and rust and thieves will destroy. Anything you store in heaven cannot be touched. So the way to be ready for the thief is to make sure your treasure is beyond their reach. They can break into your house and take all of your possessions, but they cannot take your treasure if you have understood what Jesus is teaching us and encouraging us to do. Because the only difference between the good and the bad servant in the final scenario is that the second servant says, my master is delayed, so in that delay, I'll do whatever I want. But he knows that the master is still coming. And what is he expecting to do? Tidy up quickly before the master comes? Set a watch further down the road? It won't matter because all of the servants who have been abused by him have this record against him. You know that guy that you left? What a crook. He beat us. He took all the food and the drink and he instead of serving us and feeding us, he took it down the road to the drunks. And the other servant who was just going about doing what he was told to do, just feeding everyone else in the house, just looking after people, putting his needs aside to serve, he'll get caught out with a great record on his name. The thief will sneak up on him, and it won't matter. That person is ready always. They're alert always. They're prepared. But I want to come back to my little scenario with Noah. It was Paul who said, "My spirit is willing, but my flesh is weak." And the difficulty of a life of ongoing service, the difficulty of Noah, of putting your life aside to build something that saves many, and then finding out that after all that, there's just more work to do. I mean, what does Jesus say that the faithful servant was going to get? "I'll put you in charge of all my possessions." Can you imagine that guy going, "Oh man, I wanted to retire. I thought I'd done my work." I just want to play with that a little bit. Because I think that one of the things we really do struggle with in our faith journey is just plain old fatigue. Plain old weariness. That serving others is hard work. I can think of already a couple who wanted to retire, left where they were serving, came to another place, and put their head down and thought, "I just want to retire." And then they couldn't help themselves but see needs around them and began to serve that as well. I'm so inspired by that story, and I also know what it costs to do that. And I know why we end up just eating and drinking and marrying and giving in marriage and just falling back into the absorbing daily rhythms, which are good, but in the end, they're just our little life, aren't they? They're good. Don't stop eating and drinking, please. And let's not put an end to marriages. But there's such a temptation, or so much weight that comes on us if you've served. And just listening to Marie, who so pleased that you love what you do, because it's almost the only thing that can get you through those hard times, those times of fatigue. But how many times have we read prayer requests from those on the overseas mission field? And a chunk of it is, "Can you pray for energy?" Because it's hard work, it's tiring. It's tiring. They're always about the work. Even when they're eating and drinking, they're probably doing it with others and feeding into their lives. It's right that we would pray for energy. It's right that we would pray that though the spirit is willing, the flesh is weak, Lord, strengthen the flesh. Because it was like that with Noah, wasn't it? At some point in his life, he just felt like this life of service had become a curse. I'm sure he wanted to just do what everyone else had been doing. And maybe you feel that way. Maybe you have spent a lot of time just giving out and serving others. And that's how you feel. You have felt that temptation to, "You know what, I think I'm just going to pull back a bit. I think I'm just going to find a place to be served." Now, I don't want people to burn out. And there is a need for wisdom in this. There is a need for understanding rhythms in our life, in our service. And we do need to be served and not constantly giving out. We do need rest. We need Sabbath rest. And I think if we were serving and giving of ourselves, we would understand the wisdom of the Sabbath rest even more. For the Lord would like to care for us as much as we care for others. And maybe you're on the other side, that you are the eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, that the life you're leading right now is actually just It's sweet. It's sweet. You're content with it. It doesn't feel like an overburden. It doesn't feel like you're stretched because of your service to others. Treasure. Store your treasure in heaven. Store your treasure in heaven. Have a record of good. You might well want to bank on that. Any quick reflections? Any need to clarify or to balance? I know sometimes you give a sermon, it's certainly within a particular direction, and there might be need to just balance something out that I might have overemphasized. Anything? No? Yeah. So if it's for the sake of the podcast, Jeff was saying that the word to use perhaps is sacrifice. And sharing his own part of the story of he and Jill taking on Susan and others who have encouraged them not to. But it's a work that the Lord has brought to them, and they are willing to do it, though it costs them. Yeah. All right. You all look punch drunk. Which is maybe slightly better than Noah. Let me bless you then. And we'll go and have tea and coffee. Mai hoa koe manaki, mana koe tiaki. Mai hoa e me kia ti aho tono mata kia koe. Mana hoki koe e atawhai. Mai hoa tona ka nohi e whakara kia koe. Mana anō e tuku turanga marie kia koe. May the Lord bless you and keep you. May he make his face shine upon you and be gracious to you. May he lift his countenance upon you and bring you peace. Amen.